Good evening, everyone. This is Dr. Nalini Chilko. Welcome to our live Grand Rounds call for the Foundations of Integrative Oncology course. This call will last approximately an hour to an hour and 15 minutes. I'll start with a clinical pearl and some of the questions that have been submitted. Tonight we have two case studies, and I want to also bring your attention to a paper that was recently published this fall. Everyone on the call is muted. If you want to speak, you'll hit star 7. I'll take breaks as I'm speaking to allow you to ask questions or comment. And we also have the chat feature available. If you called in through your computer and you're on a web call, then you can also type in questions. And what's really wonderful is we have people from all over the United States, and we even have someone from South Africa. So this is turning into be an international community, which is incredibly wonderful. This is the November 2018 call. We are going to take December off because it's a busy month and because I am not able to be in my home because I'm affected by the California wildfires. And so I'm going to take December to have more time to care for my home. So let's see. I'm going to start with a clinical pearl. And I wanted to talk about fasting and fasting mimicking diets briefly because it's so in the news and forefront. And I think a lot of people are confused about it. And I've had patients experiment on their own. So it's good to be able to be clear with patients. So basically, I'm going to introduce you to three papers which discuss this topic. And then you'll have the references. I'll highlight the big ideas in those papers. So the first paper is called Modulating the Effects of Chemotherapy by Fasting, Toxicity in Chemotherapy When Less is More. And this was actually published in 2012. And this is primarily a murine study, but it ended up being the basis for future studies. So remember that chemotherapy induces oxidative stress and thereby damages mitochondria and DNA and causes cancer cells to die. And when a cancer patient fasts before chemotherapy for short term, say for 12 to 24 hours, in a normal cell, the fasting will actually activate protective metabolic pathways that would confer some resistance to oxidative stress. So the healthy cells are in better shape. But the cells with activated oncogenes, they're not able to turn on this response, and so they are more vulnerable to the chemotherapy. And there's a couple of cancer centers in LA, actually, where they're fasting some of the more robust patients before chemo. And so that the big idea is the healthy cells are able to be resistant to the chemo, more protected, and the cancer cells more vulnerable. And so that's a good reason for fasting. I do have patients fast before chemotherapy if they are able to. But we're going to talk in this lecture also about fasting mimicking diets because some interesting research has come out about who really shouldn't fast. If you have the download, there's a PDF of all these slides. There's also an image just showing you what happened to tumor cells in the mice that fasted and didn't fast before chemotherapy was administered. And so what's really interesting also is that the fasting really reduces some adverse effects, particularly fatigue and lethargy and some of the GI effects, and seems to extend survival. And so that was in mice. And so we're still doing experiments on humans. I have quite a number of Walter Longo's papers here in the references for you and some of his colleagues showing that fasting and cancer treatment in humans is also valuable. Now, Dr. Longo made an interesting caution, And his studies show that patients over 65 should not do extreme fasting. And so there's a middle path for older patients. And because the demographic of cancer is older, then we want to be sure we're being safe. So what he also emphasizes is not only low calories before chemotherapy, but also lowering the protein intake if the patient's going to eat. And so there's a kind of a sweet spot because the older patients suffer from extreme fasting in that sarcopenia is part of the aging process, and also more extreme fasting for patients who fast several days. There are some organ deficits that occur, and the older patients don't recover from that as robustly. And so we don't want to do really extreme fasting in older patients, but we can do fasting mimicking diets in older patients and still get a lot of the benefits. And Dr. Longo also did studies showing the difference between lower protein and higher protein intakes. And what the impact of lower protein is, it reduces IGF-1, which is insulin-like growth factor. And there's a correlation between high IGF-1 and high proliferation and mortality, and low IGF-1 and lower rates of proliferation and overall mortality. So we want to be mindful of the age of our patients when we're looking at how we're going to restrict their diet. So a lot of studies show that there is a role for carbohydrate restriction in the treatment and prevention of cancer. And in general, and this is another paper by that title. So carbohydrate restriction also, we know, of course, lowers insulin and serum glucose. And that leads to a reduction in carcinogenesis and tumorigenesis, a delay in tumor growth, and an increase in tumor latency. And again, we get this drop in IGF-1 and insulin, which then causes the tumor cells, which are more dependent on glycolytic pathways to survive and to produce energy than the healthy cells, which can survive quite well on ketone bodies. And so in my patients, I try to produce a little mild ketosis before chemotherapy. And then in cancer survivors, I recommend doing intermittent fasting as a way to do that as well. So a lot of studies show that in the cancer setting, a low glycemic carbohydrate restricted diet, and then before chemo, we can make that a little more calorie restricted and protein restricted, actually has an impact on outcomes. And of course, it transforms the proliferative high insulin and high glucose environment and drops down the IGF-1. And so this reiterates something that I talk about a lot, and I think it's really important, at least in America, because we have so many patients who are pre-diabetic, diabetic, and obese, that we really want to be able to change the metabolism of the healthy cells and the cancer cells towards a healthier overall endpoint. So there's a number of studies that I have here for you. Now, carbohydrate restriction actually can mimic the metabolic state of calorie restriction or fasting. And so a ketogenic diet that is will inherently be low carbohydrate will give this benefit for better response to chemotherapy as well. So if you have a young patient who's quite robust, that's quite different. If you have an elderly patient who is frail and has other comorbid diseases that they're dealing with, or maybe they've had liver damage or kidney damage, and we don't want their organs to be stressed by extreme fasting. So there was a study also that I've included in here showing that the ketone bodies themselves have direct anti-tumor potential. So there is also a benefit moving people into ketosis. And you will want to do that either gently or aggressively, depending on the constitution and robustness or frailty of the patient. And I have a paper that shows that a moderate ketogenic plant-based diet, so no animal protein, so this is different than a lot of the popular ketogenic diets where people are eating a lot of animal fat and protein. So Dr. Longo has patients stay vegan, and that's an easy way also to drop protein down and have a low carbohydrate and low in animal proteins. That also then causes you to have low sulfur amino acids like methionine and low selenium. And studies show that dropping down methionine and selenium also can stress tumor cells. So the few days of the fasting mimicking diet, and Dr. Longo does that for about 5 days in some patients, he actually recommends everybody do 5 days of a fasting mimicking diet or a fast once a month for longevity. That's not specific to cancer, but to his longevity studies. He has a longevity institute at the University of Southern California. So this type of a fasting mimicking ketogenic plant-based diet actually does create a hostile environment to tumor cells. And so shifts immune factors, it shifts the circulating metabolites and inflammation. And what's interesting is it has a big impact on the microbiome, both producing more short-chain fatty acids like butyrate, which are the fuel of the microbiota. And also some studies show that there's an increase in an organism in the microbiome called Ekkermansia, which is kind of newly getting a lot of focus to be promoting immune function and good repair of the intestinal lining. So this type of a diet then also leverages a healthier microbiome, which is always a challenge in cancer patients who've had chemotherapy, because it very much wipes out their microbiome and then you have to really rebuild it. There's a third paper here that I want to emphasize, and it's really fabulous. It's called Pushing the Limits of Cancer Therapy, The Nutrient Game. And it was published in May of this year. And there's a really nice infographic that I've included. And so you can take a look at that. And it shows very clearly how prolonged fasting and fasting mimicking and ketogenic diets impact metabolism in terms of glucose, IGF-1, the sulfur amino acids, and the ketone bodies, as we've mentioned. And then he has also showing the impact of ketogenic plant-based diets on all of these metabolic functions as well. And also there's references to the different immune functions that are activated or inhibited. You get a lowering of NF-kappa-B. You get an increase in lymphocytes. And so then you're going to change the neutrophil to lymphocyte ratio, which is very prognostic. And then you get this change in the microbiome, and the organisms most impacted are there. So the impact of doing fasting or fasting mimicking diets, low carbohydrate, relatively low protein, and if possible, a window where the whole diet is vegan, has a very wide impact on metabolism, immunity, and the microbiome. So the answer to the question, should cancer patients fast, is yes, they should either fast or they should do a fasting mimicking diet, whatever is safer for them to do. So I wanted to bring up some of these points so that when patients ask you, you can also have some more information. There's really good papers in here. So I will just pause, and if anyone wants to comment or ask questions, then we can take a few moments to do that relative to this topic. Remember, you have to press *7 if you want to talk. So I don't see any in the chat box, and I don't see anybody unmuting themselves. So I will go on. There were a couple of questions. Two from Carol. How do you deal with those patients you watch pass on? So the last call that we did was one in which I presented a lot of patient stories about how I communicate with patients at every stage of the journey, including facing death. So, there's only one thing that's certain after birth, and that's death. So, you know, it tends to be a topic that is taboo in our culture and also in medicine. And so I really try to create a setting where the patient knows they can talk about it. Death is never a failure. If we can help the patient have a conscious end of life where they make their peace with themselves and others, are able to have closure, then I think we've done a wonderful job for them. So that is my feeling, that just in the way there's labor and delivery and then birth, there's also a similar sacred process as we go through our dying process and exit this life. So there's some really beautiful books. Joan Halifax has written a book called Being with Dying, and also another book, Standing at the Edge, which are beautiful resources for how to be with patients. And you know, we don't typically receive training in how to be with people when they're dying. So I actually took some formal training so that I could be better being with patients. So you all have to find your way as well. So I try to help the patient feel like their death isn't a failure also, but sometimes we have to be the ones that tell the patient to prepare for their death. Carol has another question. How would you recommend nourishing a patient when they get so sick from the treatments and that even a shake makes them sick? I use bone broth, congee, ginger tea, lemon water, etc. Would love to know if you have any other recommendations. So first of all, I encourage all patients to have their nausea well managed. So if the nausea is from the drugs, then you have a chance to have it well managed. So a lot of my patients don't want to take any medication, but I encourage them to take the anti-nausea medication as directed so that they can stay replete in their calories and nutrients. Certainly ginger is very effective, and so is acupuncture, but those are kind of short acting. So patients who have the lining of their GI tract is sloughing off, or they have mucositis in their mouth, then you want to use glutamine to try and repair that. Want to have people eat mostly cooked warm foods, not a lot of rough foods like raw salads, and make sure that the patient is replete with fluids and electrolytes. If they really can't eat, then they should have IV fluid and electrolytes for a couple of days after the chemo. And, you know, bone broth is really an excellent choice if someone is not vegan, because there's 10 grams of protein in a cup of real bone broth and lots of minerals and electrolytes if it was made with vegetables. So I think that's great. I also, you can put the Chinese mushroom powders into the broth also and make it a more therapeutic broth. You can cook astragalus into it. The Chinese mushrooms would be like Ganoderma, Coriolis, Cordyceps. And I like the Clinical Synergy Mycoceutix Immunex powder. They can just put a couple scoops of that in when they drink the broth to help their digestive tract and inflammation and immunity. You could put ginger and cinnamon into things, which warm up the digestion. Not a big fan of congee because it's too high in carbohydrates. So although it's some calories, it's not really the best choice. You can also, if they're getting really weak, you can think about giving good, strong red panax ginseng, which is also really great for digestion. There are some traditional Chinese formulas. There's a patent medicine called Po Chai pills. There's also a famous formula called curing formula. Comes in little pills called curing pills. And so you can give patients things like that. Those are not expensive. And you can order them online, or most Chinese herb shops in Chinatown has those. And also Clinical Synergy makes a lovely kind of herbal product called Complete Digestive Balance in capsules, which is nice. And, you know, make sure they get some extra fat so they're getting some calories. And slippery elm powder is a really nice thing to give to soothe the lining of the gut as well. And you want to make sure you're working on the microbiome with both probiotics and prebiotics. I like the Claire products a lot. We mentioned repairing the lining with glutamine. Also, these patients tend to be low in magnesium and potassium. So again, a nice vegetable broth could take care of some of that. And they could take magnesium powder if they're having trouble with, you know, swallowing capsules. Sometimes head and neck cancer patients, you know, they get really swollen and they can't really swallow. Most of my patients are able to continue to take oral calories, but a lot of people have to get a feeding tube. But I've never had any of my patients have to do that. Also, some liquid B-complex would be nice. Pure encapsulation makes a methylated liquid B-complex. And if you're an acupuncturist, you know, I would do stomach 36, spleen 3, CB14, CB12. And then I might do heart 7, spleen 4, and pericardium 6, and kidney 16, large intestine 11, large intestine 4, and liver 3, and maybe ear shen men. Or you could just do moxibustion to stomach 36 and CB12. So there's also, I wanted to mention, that there is also a product by Integrative Therapeutics called the Elemental Diet, and it's a powder. And if somebody can't eat at all and can't take the shake at all, they can get 1,800 calories in a completely absorbable digestive form of free amino acids and some partially hydrolyzed carbohydrates and medium chain triglycerides. And so they can absorb nutrients from their GI lumen. And if they really can't eat, that's a solution. It comes in a 1,800 calorie bag and also in a 5,300 calorie bag. It's quite expensive, but if somebody can't eat it all, it could keep their some of their nutrients and calories up and protect them from having loss of muscle mass. So if it's really extreme, you can use a product like that. And so you can look that up on the Integrative Therapeutics website. There's some nice literature on that. So those were the questions. So again, I will pause if anyone wants to add anything or ask a question. Let me pause so you could do that. Okay. So let me go into the case studies because we have two really interesting case studies. So the first case study is from Judy Pruszynski, and it is a ductal carcinoma in situ with estrogen receptor positive. And the patient is 76 years old, of Irish heritage. And Judy also feels this might be a not very engaged highly compliant patient because she feels that her cancer is gone because she had surgery now and she had clean margins. So here's the thing. DCIS is considered stage zero. Some people don't really even consider it to be a cancer at all. There are some studies that were done many years ago in Sweden on DCIS patients where some were treated and some were not treated at all. And in a large percentage of patients, the DCIS resolved. So it's really a precancer. So it really depends on the oncologist sometimes over-treat. So this patient, though, if we look at the rest of the history, has a tumor microenvironment that could be supportive of proliferation. So, you know, this might be a good teaching moment for her to motivate her to change her diet and her lifestyle a bit. She has a history of obesity, insulin resistance, hypertension, sleep apnea, which contributes to all of that. She has a hiatal hernia, and overall, Judy says she has poor nutritional status. So this could be a wake-up call for her, even though she's 76. You know, she might want another 20 years. So we could say, well, if you do and you want that to be good quality of life, then here's some things you can do about that and reduce your risk of a recurrence as well. I also, in a patient this age, want to consider their cognitive health and their bone health. And remember that this, at this age, their ability to produce hydrochloric acid and digestive enzymes is also compromised. So we want to attend to the whole health. This patient does have a history of hormone replacement therapy. She had a history of endometriosis, so she's sensitive to estrogen. And she had a hip replacement, and it's not clear whether that was due to arthritis and degeneration or due to osteoporosis. So we'd want to, again, make sure that joint health and bone health were addressed for a patient like this, because we don't want to be siloed like the specialists. We want to still take care of the whole health of our patients. So what I did, I gave you a handout that was as if the patient had a more developed breast cancer, just so you have all the things you could think about doing with a patient like this. But this is not the type of protocol you would have to do. But this patient would get super healthy if she was willing to do it. So if you had to pick a few things, you might pick a multi, just to cover the bases, this age group, and this person also just doesn't eat well. So we want to get some kind of insurance policy for micronutrients. We want her to take vitamin D. We'd want her to take some form of probiotics. And then you might want to think about managing inflammation well with something like the omega-3 fatty acids and curcumin. I'm starting to put annatto tocotrienols into my treatment plan. I've been reading a lot of studies, and this is one of the great multitasker molecules, and it has an impact on glycemic control as well as cancer proliferation, so it fits nicely for this patient. About 250 to 500 milligrams a day, and maybe some Chinese mushrooms. So that would give her health, right? That's going to give her health. And to address her cardiovascular health, maybe we'd put in some Cretaceous, some hawthorn berry. Maybe for her hypertension, we'd think about taurine. We might want to give her like a good pancreatic ox bile digestive enzyme. At this age, you consider hydrochloric acid, betaine hydrochloride as well. So that would optimize her. Sometimes patients of this age group have trouble sleeping, so then you can think about melatonin at the higher dose that would also then have an impact on breast cancer risk. And then I gave you some compounded herb formulas, some Chinese herb formulas. One is an example of a formula I give to patients to promote bone health and brain health. And you can see the herbs in that. And we could certainly discuss it if you want to. And then I gave another tonic that's an example of a tumor control tonic that also has some adaptogens in it for the stress. So I always think about that. I would try to get this patient to do some kind of intermittent fasting. And maybe she'd like to do, if she has the funds, she'd like to do a little IV vitamin C and glutathione just to feel better. And I do certainly put her, do the cancer terrain labs on her, and because it might be also a way to motivate her if you see things that need to be targeted. So when patients aren't really engaged, sometimes we need to show them concrete things. I might, in my practice, have her meet with my nutrition coach. Certainly, I encourage her to get some exercise for her bone health and brain health and glycemic control and her weight. I always ask people what their spiritual inclinations are and encourage them to take some sacred time in meditation or prayer or visualization. And I want to make sure that she's sleeping well. And then if we thought we needed to do something more cytotoxic, I gave you a protocol that I do in breast cancer patients, but I wouldn't even call this a breast cancer patient. I think if we start doing that, then we start thinking of DCIS as a syndrome that needs aggressive care. So I think that oncologists mislead patients quite a lot. GV indicates that the traditional Chinese medicine diagnosis is heart-kidney, and that, you know, that's also about emotions. And so I would inquire, you know, what her challenges are in her life as an elder and try to help her to have more resilience and coping skills. So I'll stop there. I know, Judy, you probably have some things you want to ask. So you can unmute yourself by hitting *7. And let me just manually unmute you just in case something's going on.
Hello.
Okay. Hi. Hi,
Did
Judy.
That work?
Yep.
Hi, Nalini. Hi, great. Thanks. As you saw from what I had put down as her supplements, I was pretty much having her on what you said. And my biggest question was those additional, like the sulforaphane, the catechins, those kind of things, if it was really necessary, if I could drop back on that, since it's not a, quote, cancer per se.
Yeah, I'll see what she wants to do. And then, you know, in a patient like this who's comorbid and older, like, what would we get the most mileage from, right? We might want to see if she would take tocotrienols. I think that would be a good thing to do.
And you would,
you know, maybe, like, I try to, like, walk people into this too, like, give her some things that will definitely help her to feel better. And then once she has that experience, she might be more motivated to add another supplement or two.
So I've been seeing her for a couple years, so it's mm-hmm. been pre-cancer, and she's actually quite compliant, and she does respond really well. The food, you know, some people just can lock on to food changes, and some people, that's their
yeah.
biggest resistance.
Yeah.
That's her biggest resistance. Usually I have people jump all over it, but she just could care less about changing her diet. But with this diagnosis, she has. It has been a huge motivator for her. Unfortunately, she doesn't like shakes. She hates the taste of the shake. So, but that's okay. I haven't seen her. I've been out of the country for a month, so I see her tomorrow. So it's perfect that we've had this call. So I'll see how she's doing. But I have my fingers crossed that, you know, she's been compliant. So
And
I don't know about the Cancer Terrain Labs. I'm actually not familiar with them.
So I need to do, I actually have a lecture on that I need to add to this course so that you guys
can
know.
Great.
But, you know, so we look at the glycemic control, certainly we look at inflammation, and we look at coagulation factors, and if it's germane, we look at tumor markers, but sometimes they don't help us at all. So you can, you know, also look at her neutrophil to lymphocyte ratio, and so you can get a sense. And then if there is something there, you can show it to her and say, let's see if we can improve this. And here's, you could eat a more anti-inflammatory diet, and I won't have to give you more pills, you know. I do say that sometimes. Patients don't have to do the shake. The shake is an insurance policy for people who won't eat enough nutrients on their own. And so if a person will have a healthy breakfast and lunch dinner, then they, if they're going to be able to get their nutrients through their diet, they don't have to do a shake. But I like to add still the carnitine and the mushrooms that I put in most shakes to their diet. And those things they can just put in some water and drink or take in capsules. So the shake is not mandatory, but during treatment, especially when people aren't interested in food, don't feel like eating, or they're super fatigued, it can be a strategy, but it's not required.
Okay. And if I don't know what's happened in this last month, it was going to be depending on her oncotype results. If she was advised to go with radiation, is there anything you would add in there?
Well, I think that would be overdrive because...
I do too. You know, I do too, but I'm just saying in case she has started.
Well, they probably give her just not very much anyway. So you just protect the skin, you know, and otherwise it's not a systemic treatment. But there was a paper that Dr. Lise Altshuler presented at the last naturopathic oncology conference determining who should and shouldn't have radiation. And that paper used the size of the tumor as a guideline. And so there is no tumor. I mean, there's this little tiny few millimeters. So I don't think that there's a good rationale for doing radiation. I think that, you know, some cancer groups do these things so nobody will sue them, you know, for legal reasons, not medical reasons, or because a oncologist isn't certain and they want to cover their bases. So I think my approach is to help the patient be a more educated patient so that they are part of the decision-making process. I think that radiation would be an overdrive on this, especially since she had completely clear margins and it is GIS. So I just think that would be overdrive. And in that older patient, why put her through it?
Great. I agree. Let's keep our fingers crossed that this last month didn't bring her to it. A question about hormone. I see that my case study submission sort of cut off some of the info. So she was estrogen and progesterone positive. Is there anything that you would change knowing that?
No, because she's not making any in her body. So, she's not going to have high levels anyway. So, there's no rationale either to give her estrogen blockade because, you know, her estrogen is probably on the floor. So, my focus for a patient like this would be to promote their quality of life, their brain health, their bone health, preserve their muscle mass, optimize their digestion. Just give her good quality of life. Help her not be frightened, but rather be motivated. Like I'd say, let's buy you another 20 years. Here's what you need to do. And just focus on the health aspect because that it should be a conversation about health, not disease, in terms of her DCIS.
Okay. And what do you think about berberine for her?
Oh, that would be good. Yeah, that would be a good idea because that would be a multitasker in terms of her glycemic control, her gut, and her blood sugar. So, the cancer. So, that would be great. Berberine would be great. Okay. Or I put in the tonics, I'd put scutellaria in there, which is a source of berberine. But certainly. And I'd look at her blood clotting factors, also look at her fibrinogen and her inflammation markers and see if she's at risk for a thrombus just because of her age. And I just use it as an opportunity that she could feel really much better. And, you know, if she lives 10, 15, even 20 more years, that those years are ones in which she can engage fully in life.
Great. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Does anybody else want to chime in? You can hit *7. Okay, here's Stacy's case. Dr. Stacy DeAndre is an oncologist. And Judy, you have to mute yourself. Oh, I guess I can do it. Hold on. Okay. This is a glioblastoma multiform patient, and this is a 61-year-old Hispanic male who's a retired police officer. He had a lesion in his left temporal lobe. He had unmethylated tumor cells, which is a poor prognosis, and he declined radiotherapy after his first resection, and then he had a recurrence within 3 months. And he is now undergoing treatment with low-dose Timodar, which is an alkylating and methylating agent used in brain cancers. And he's also now having radiotherapy focally where the lesion was. These are tough cancers. You know, they just grow like wildfire, partly because the brain is so vascular. And so, and then the blood-brain barrier can either be your friend protecting the brain or keep things out. So Stacy says also that he just doesn't have good coping skills and he's not great with stress and his wife's super anxious and they're having conflict at home. So, you know, this man is not going to live a long, long time, most likely. So I would also help his wife and help him be with this so that their time together is loving and intimate rather than contentious. And help the wife deal with her anxiety. I always say to the partner, you know, the significant other needs as much support as the patient. And so if she doesn't have the right support, then I would help her to get that. Also, they're considering Optune, which is an electrical treatment. It's a treatment where the patient wears electrodes on their skull and they have to wear this thing 18 hours a day. They carry around a little device in a little backpack and creates an electric field which inhibits the tumor cells. And I have only had one patient who tried it and she felt it was so cumbersome and so many hours of the day, she just didn't want to use it. And so I don't have any experience with a patient using it, but evidently the studies show that it can slow down the proliferation and progression. The goals of this patient are really about quality of life and side effects management. And then there's a really nice treatment plan that was put together. I adjusted some doses on it. So I go up on the fish oils if the patient can tolerate 6 grams of fish oil a day and 6 grams of curcumin and up to 5 grams of resveratrol because all those things cross the blood-brain barrier. But you have to get to a pretty high dose to get some into the brain. So if the patient could afford that and could tolerate that, and we didn't anticoagulate them, I would try that. I understand that this is retired police officers, so money might be tight. So we'd want to pick the most essential things, in which case I'd stick with the fish oil and curcumin for sure. And then you had also put in Boswellia for brain edema. That's one of my favorite things to use in these patients. And there's a probiotic in the plan. I particularly like the Claire Target GBX, which is designed for the gut-brain relationship and pathways. And then Stacy also is looking at a multivitamin. Of course, that'd be copper-free and iron-free. She has magnesium in the plan. Think about magnesium threonate, which is more ends up in the brain. So you could think about that combined with some magnesium glycinate so that the mitochondria and the tissue stores are also repleted. He could certainly drink green tea. Would he drink 5 to 10 cups a day or should he take some capsules of the ECGC? You know, to sort of see what he'll do and what he could afford. Quercetin was added as a PARP inhibitor. I usually use niacinamide as a PARP inhibitor. And also, I had one of my patients take Lynparza, olaparib, for their glioblastoma. The oncologist was willing to do that. So, you know, you could consider that also. I have some notes from Donnie Yance at the end of this. He was one of my teachers where tamoxifen was also used. These patients should also be worked up for CMV, cytomegalovirus. Some of them are positive for it. And you can think about giving antivirals. So there's some things that never get looked at in conventional oncology with these patients. Stacy has lion's mane in there, which is great for the brain. Melatonin at high dose, great. Some CBD and THC, great. And she has them on a ketogenic diet, stress reduction, walking, camp, and counseling. And then, you know, see if they have a church community or religious or spiritual belief that might help them, or they might be open to meeting with their priest or minister or something like that. Also, I like to think about herbs that would improve cognitive function and brain health, things like bacopa, which is Brahmi in Ayurvedic medicine, gotukola, and ginkgo. You can think about things like that. I always use acetyl L-carnitine, so that's something I definitely add in. And you can also think about more mitochondrial support as well. Sometimes I'll use the Designs for Health mitochondrial energy formula as the multi for patients like this. So you could look at that formula. And then it's so stressful, so I always put in some adaptogens, some astragalus and Ganoderma could be put in, some ashwagandha maybe. And I didn't see vitamin D in your protocol, but I'm sure you meant to put it in there. So I would do a vitamin D level, see what he needs. And then the shake, if he'll do a shake, should be ketogenic and without fruit, and maybe some extra digestive enzymes, because we like this to be a super high-fat shake. And so then I always give lipase with that shake. And you can put extra acetyl L-carnitine in the shake. You could put phosphatidylcholine, phosphatidylserine. The Donnie Yance formula, Botanical Treasures, is a nice formula with green tea, resveratrol, and curcumin in it. I'd also put some MCT oil in the shake, and lots of fats like avocado and coconut milk and nut butter and whatever he would like to put in there and make it really fatty and try to supply some calories and some inflammation control that way, and tip them into a little bit of ketosis, which really helps with brain issues. Now, in the labs, these are two things that popped out at me. It has an extremely high neutrophil to lymphocyte ratio. It is over 11. So that's really high. That's really, really poor prognosis. So I would watch that to see trend. Because if he starts some of your interventions and that starts to shift, at least you're improving his physiology. But the other thing that concerns me is he has low albumin, and that's also a very poor prognostic sign. And then he would be really at risk for sarcopenia and fatigue also. So, quality of life is super important here. He'd probably feel better if he was in a little ketosis, and you can't put a patient like this on a fast, but you can give him a mildly ketogenic diet that he can tolerate and digest and not have diarrhea on it. I also added notes from Donnie Yance from a case of mine that I presented to him many years ago, and he added St. John's wort, hypericum, and taurine to the treatment plan. He was very big on N-acetyltocotrienols for the brain. He also included omega-6 fatty acids in the form of borage oil, and also hanokiol for patients with glioblastoma. He's not a fan of Timidor, but he is a fan of PARP inhibitors and tamoxifen in these patients. He also has recommended irinotecan and vinorelbine, nevelbine, and gefitinib, Iressa. So you could look a little outside the box if he's not responsive to the Timidar, which is kind of the only thing that has thought about in oncology for these patients, and see if you could get permission to introduce anything else and test to see if he's positive for CMV. That might make a difference for him. And I put a few other PARP inhibitors just for your edification, green tea and curcumin, mild PARP inhibitors, and then the niacinamide is what I use the most. And then I would think about, if he'll do some anti-tumor herbs, some things like Ovenlandia, Salvia milchiriza, Camptothica. If irinotecan is going to work, Camptothica would work. And then Donnie Yance has a formula, Phytocyto, which has Taxus brevia in it and brevifolia. And that is from the yew tree. That's where we get some of our botanical anti-tumor agents. And so you could think about that. You could also think about Madagascar periwinkle, which is catharansis, and that's anti-tumor as well. So you maybe think about that. You could think about polygonatum, which is Solomon's seal, and that kind of interrupts some of the mitochondrial and anti-apoptotic pathways, because this is growing a lot. So those are my thoughts on that. So Stacey, if you want to ask questions and, you know, have more discussion, or anybody else, we can certainly do that.
Hi, this is Stacey. Can you hear me?
You are. Yep.
I'm here in the smoke.
Yeah, me too. I'm evacuated from my house. I haven't been home since last week.
Awful.
Yeah.
Awful.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I didn't know about the niacinamide, so that would be something to look at. And what's the dose on that?
About 2 grams a day. You can, Douglas Labs makes a 500 milligram capsule, so then it's only 2 grams a day.
Okay, that's good. And, yeah, I read about the PARP inhibitors, because patients who are not methylated, there's new research showing that the PARP inhibitors may actually help those patients more. And because Temodar is really limited, we've used Carbo, we've used irinotecan. I usually start some Avastin.
Uh-huh.
Like if he doesn't, if he progresses, I put him on, that would be my go-to, would be Avastin. Just to kind of keep swelling down, and sometimes people have some good responses with that.
A little bit. So for people who don't know, Avastin is a vascular endothelial growth factor inhibitor, so it puts the brakes on proliferation and metastasis. What else?
So yeah, these are tough.
Oh, they're so tough, you know. But it's my experience, people get Temodar resistant pretty quickly. Is that your?
Especially if they're not, well, if they're not methylated, they just really don't respond nearly as well. So I have a very low threshold for, you know, just giving them a short course of that. And if it doesn't seem to be doing anything, we'll switch them over to something else relatively rapidly. If you're methylated, the Temodar can work. I mean, I've got people out, you know, 4 or 5 years. But those are people who are methylated. And then, of course, immunotherapy is, you know, all the what everybody's studying right now. And some really promising work is coming out with, like, dendritic cell vaccines and some other vaccines. So it's coming. It's just not quite – they're figuring out which type of immunotherapy is you know, how do you do it? Because there's so many different ways of doing it.
Don't you worry about brain swelling with that?
You can see some with the when you actually inject the vaccine directly into the tumor. But when you're doing dendritic cell vaccine, since it's more systemic, or if you're doing like nivolumab, you know, just those type of drugs, you don't really see much swelling.
Good. Good to know.
But I like the Boswellia, because that should help with that too. So.
Yeah, and you can go up on that. Curcumin is also great as a, and the omega-3 fatty acids all have some anti-inflammatory impact on the brain.
Oh, that sounds good.
So is he compliant with your program?
Yeah, they're really
on board
into that.
Uh-huh.
They're on
good.
Board with that. He is in ketosis. I mean, mild. He's been following that diet, and you know, it's just getting them to counseling and just dealing with the anxiety. He's not anxious. She, the wife, so just dealing with the interpersonal stuff is difficult. But no, he's definitely on board with all this stuff.
Fantastic. That's fantastic. Yeah. Well, acupuncture is helpful also, just to sort of support more normal neurologic function. And also it's great, give it to the wife for anxiety.
Maybe I'll refer her.
Yeah.
For some acupuncture.
Yeah, you know, or just to be touched in a healing way. That's sometimes nice with acupuncture as well, because most people are not prepared for this and, you know, don't have the coping skill.
Right. I guess my only other question would be with the lion's mane. I've been reading, you got to push the dose kind of high.
Yeah, I didn't really
see how much. It just said, like, because normally we do, like, what, about 2 grams of the mushrooms, but with lion's mane, you might have to go higher, but I didn't know how much higher.
Well, so first of all, there's no toxicity with these. Are kind of like, think of them like concentrated food. So there's a class of botanicals and mushrooms in Chinese medicine called the imperial herbs. And these are the great tonics that can be taken every day for your whole life. And they're really more nourishing, food-like, and not drug-like, even though they have, you know, activity and pathways. But there are things that really promote healthy function for the most part. So you can go up 5-6 grams, you know.
And I
want patients to do that. I get the powder and have them just put it in tea or their shake or something so that they're not taking them out in a pill. Or soup. Very nice to put it in soup. They don't have, the Chinese mushrooms don't have a strong taste at all. They're kind of bland. So they taste like mushrooms. So, that's a nice way to do it. You know, they can cook with shiitake mushrooms, which you can get readily in grocery stores in California. So you can teach them a few things that will be helpful. But the lion's mane is quite good. You could also think about acetylcholine, which there's lots of studies on cognitive impairment related to cancer and cancer treatments. It's just really a source of choline, as is phosphatidylcholine. You could think about phosphatidylserine, you know, just to help the brain cells be healthier.
Sounds good.
Well, there are also some functional medicine docs that do IV phosphatidylcholine. I don't have experience with it, but it can be quite powerful. Just for the health side. It's not going to do anything for the cancer. But, you know, if he's feeling like he's losing some function, it can be helpful. It's also been strong detox. Do you have any relationships with functional medicine doctors in your area?
Well, I'm trying to be one.
Yeah, you must do everything or know everything, so. You know,
because I've done my, I'm almost done with my IFM training, so, but I'm still in my infancy. There are some folks up the road, up the hill, we say, and they do some IV therapies.
Yeah. So you might want to think about that just to help them to feel better, you know? And also, if you've come across Mark Menalasino in your IFM training, he's really, really knowledgeable in brain health, and he's also very generous. You might want to reach out to him.
What's his last name again?
Menalasino, M-E-N-O-L-A-S-C-I-N-O.
Wow, okay.
Everybody calls him Dr. Mino, but he's on the IFM faculty.
All right, cool. I'll look that up.
Yeah, and if you can't reach him, I know how to reach him, but he's very knowledgeable. He may have some other ideas.
Great.
Okay. So, anything else? Does anybody else want to ask any questions or make any comments or, reflect back on the year of calls we've been on, a lot of us together? There are, now I'm looking at all the people on the call from Canada, Africa, all over the United States. It's really fabulous. So anyone else that wishes to to unmute themselves and share anything, ask any questions, comment, please feel free to do so. Our next guest will be in January of next year. Patty, did you have a... You unmuted
Hello,
yourself?
Hello. Yes.
Hi.
Hi. Hi. You mentioned a bunch of herbs that I couldn't catch, salvia and Madagascar.
Oh, yeah. Okay. All right. Let me repeat that slowly. It's in the notes. You should have gotten copies, or there are downloadable copies of my notes on these cases, and there are downloadable copies of the slides also. So they're on the website. What I mentioned was Oldenlandia, which is a very, very powerful anti-tumor herb. It's high in ursolic acid, and it's one of my favorite herbs. Lots of studies on it. It's
Oldenlandia. Oldenlandia.
Olden. Oldenlandia. Landia.
Hmm.
And then these are Chinese herbs. Salvia miltiariza, I've spoken about that quite a lot. That's Chinese red sage root. It's one of the great multitaskers. It's used quite a lot for patients who have fibrosis, but it enters a number of pathways. It is pro-apoptotic, anti-proliferative, and it's deep red. It has a lot of antioxidants in it as well. It's one of my absolute favorite Chinese herbs. You can think about using something called camptotheca, which impacts the topoisomerase 1 pathway. And so if that's involved in a patient, then you can use that. This is one of the original botanical sources for irinotecan, which is a chemotherapy agent. And then Donald Jantz has a formula that's sold only to clinicians. It's called a phytocyto, and it's got a number of very cytotoxic herbs in it. And two of the most powerful are Taxus brevifolia, and that's quite often used when taxanes are used in breast cancer. So there's a rationale for including that in quite a lot of patients. And also there's catharanthus. The common name is Madagascar periwinkle, Catharanthus rosea. And that's a very, now these are very toxic. So if you have no training in using these herbs, you really should not use them because they're super toxic. So, but I often will pulse these in cancer patients. I will do that sometimes in between therapy, but more I'll do it after they finish their conventional cancer treatment, and then I'll have them do cytotoxic therapy for 2 weeks, during which they also get IV vitamin C and do a ketogenic diet, you know, 2 weeks every season, so that we do something that might scavenge some microscopic tumor cells. So that's how I think about those herbs. But if you have no training, no formal training in using super toxic herbs, you shouldn't do that. But the Oldenlandia and the salvia are the fine to use.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
What was your background?
I'm a nutritionist. I went through Andrea Nakayama's program, and that's how I learned about you. And a lot of this is a little bit over my head, I have to say. But I do get patients, and I just need to know something while I'm working with them, which is why I took your training.
Wonderful. Wonderful.
Yeah. I have a patient who has colon cancer, and he has a colostomy, and he's had a bunch of chemo, and then he went into remission, and then it came back, and he's in more chemo, and his wife called me and said, "You got to do something with him. He's not eating. You know, he's losing weight," and, you know, and I question, what do you do with someone who just has no appetite at all?
They have to make themselves eat, you know? I mean, you know, a lot of drugs just take your appetite away, or the die-off of the tumor cells in the digestive tract makes you feel like you don't want to eat. So I would, you know, if you have an ostomy, then you don't want to have a super high fiber diet because you don't want a lot of bulky stool, but you can make it nutrient dense. And, you know, if he did 2 shakes a day, he could get a lot of nutrients, and or make some soups that he would do, some blended soups that he likes, so that he's going to get some nutrients and calories. Because if his cancer is advanced, then it's also he's tipping into cachexia, it sounds like. And so that's a downhill slide where you rapidly lose weight and muscle mass and have super high inflammation. So you don't want him to go there. So see what he likes to eat, see the taste he likes, and see if you can just find a few things that he would just do. Because if he feels better, you know, I always ask patients, just humor me and try this, you know. And if you feel better, keep doing it. And if it doesn't make a dent, stop doing it, you know. And so patients are overwhelmed, and having one more new thing to do can be daunting. But if they just do it for 2 weeks and they feel better, then they'll keep doing it.
You know, I gave him he took one probiotic, and he had such diarrhea from it. And his oncologist said that he cannot take probiotics if you have an ostomy. Is that true?
Well, it depends where it is. If it's very high up, it doesn't really have an impact, so. If it's lower down, then you can take probiotics. So if that's, you know, you need to know where the ostomy is. But
it's in the cecum. I mean, I know that his cancer is in the cecum.
So I don't withhold probiotics from people who have an ostomy that's near the end of the intestinal tract. I don't, because it's part of normal health. And so I don't, but he probably just had a Herkimer reaction where there was a little war going on between the healthy and the unhealthy bacteria in his gut. So he might do fine if you give him fermented food.
So
what I want you to do is, if you want to discuss this case more, do a case presentation, you know, do the whole thing, fill out the case form and get more information, so that we're just not talking generally for him, but we could really talk more specifically.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Okay, anybody else? Okay, everyone. Well, we've come to the end of our time. I hope that you all have lovely holidays, and we will reconvene in January. And so that gives you plenty of time if you want to generate some questions or case studies, and we will pick up where we left off. You can also let me know what you'd like to have discussed in terms of clinical pearls. So I could definitely do one on biomarkers and lab tests. We could definitely start that conversation, look at more of those things. And then, you know, I brought up the neutrophil to lymphocyte ratio and the low albumin in this discussion of Dr. DeAndre's glioblastoma patient. So, you know, take note of those things so that you start tracking them in your patients as well. So thank you, everyone, and I will look forward to all being together again in a couple of months. Thank you.